Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley, your host, and tonight we're talking about DOA. The 1949/50 version, not the 1988 version. Maybe we'll get to that, but that's not what we're talking about. I'm sorry. Oh, wrong show.
Wait, we're not talking about Nick of Time with Johnny Depp?
No, not that either. You know what? I feel like I've gotten people here on false pretenses, and those people are David J. Lohr. Welcome. Hi.
Hi. Why, yes, that is a slide whistle in my pocket, but I'm very happy to be here.
Also, Nathan J. Alderman, who may also have Nathan J. Alderman. Why did I just do that? Also, I think I've done it before, too. That's what's hilarious.
I'm pretty sure you have.
And also, Nathan Alderman, hello. Do you have a slide whistle? Do I want to ask that question?
I plead the fifth.
Well, gentlemen, we are here to talk about the 1949/50. And I say that because various references refer to it as one year or the other. And it doesn't matter to me, except that when I'm sorting my movies on my Plex server as 40s and I can't find DOA, it's like, oh, yeah. It thinks it's 1950. Doesn't really matter other than that. This is a movie starring Edmund O'Brien and some other people, most of whom even... classic movie nerds haven't heard of, directed by Rudolf Matej. It's his first movie, and you know, pretty interesting in that regard. So this is not one of those movies where we're going to talk about the fourth character actor from the left, because most of them aren't super well known. But
I have a fourth character actor from the left who I cannot wait.
But... Well, I have one too, and it'll be interesting to see if it's the same one. But
I mean, I've got at least one too.
Oh, I love it! All right, maybe I should
I
read
bet
in my
it's
introduction.
All the same person. I bet it's all the same
That'd
person.
Be hilarious.
Really, I have three. I have one,
and I have so many stories. Anyways, so here we are. DOA. It is a classic of film noir and a movie that is widely available in public domain format. It's been restored, but just to say that DOA is easily available for one to see, and a great movie in terms of just sort of plot mechanics and in terms of visual style, I think. But I would love to hear you guys. What's your history with DOA, first of all, and then also what's your sort of top line feeling about the movie?
Well, I've been very familiar with the plot for years because it's a great hook. Right. It's a really good hook for a plot. And it is kind of one of those prototypical film noir concepts. It's irony. It's the Rod Serling's favorite thing of the fear of the unknown acting on you, except there's nothing supernatural about this. And it does have some great shots. I think it's really interestingly filmed. I'm bored to tears by the plot, because, you know, it's all about notarizing and stolen iridium and luminous poison. But that scene where he starts running through the crowd because he can't believe he's been poisoned. That's a great shot. That's, you know, there's so many interesting things. So much of it is shot in San Francisco at the time, which is interesting to see. It's like, oh, wow, you did this. And it uses the Bradbury Building, which most Incomparable listeners will probably know from Blade Runner or Demon with a Glass Hand from The Outer Limits. And it's like, oh, my God, it's there again. Awesome. But, yeah, I mean, the plot is just I go cross-eyed. I'm just like, you know, and it kind of makes sense by the end, but eh?
Yeah, the plot here makes The Big Sleep look like a children's book.
Yeah, it's really complicated. And as I was saying to the guys before we started, that I wrote it all down in case it became relevant. And I said plot mechanics specifically because the idea is you have a guy who starts out the movie going, somebody's killed me, and we spend the entire movie finding out how and why. And that's interesting, but the methods by which this has happened and the plots and the names of the people. Wait, okay, how many people's? And then there's one guy who has multiple names. It's like, stop it. Just stop it right now. You just have to give up.
The whole thing plays like a spoof of film noir, right? It's like every Rubik's Cube twist the plot takes is ridiculous. The shots, I mean, some of them are classic shots, but some of them are almost like, yeah, this is too much. You just went a little too much. It's pitch perfect, but it's a little silly. And even the whole thing, you know, there was a murder committed last night. Who was the victim? It was me. Right? I mean, it's just, and even the final moment where he finally does drop dead. What should we say, Chief? Call it dead on arrival. And that's the end of the movie. And it's like, well, yeah, but I mean, I cracked up through the whole thing. It's really interesting that way. There's a reason why the remake literally takes the hook and nothing else from this movie.
Yeah, it's a really well-made bad movie. It has a great hook. The cinematography is beautiful. There are some tracking shots, some really great use of camera motion. I mean, yes. Rudolf Matej is the guy who was the cinematographer for crying out loud on The Passion of Jeanne d'Arc by Carl Theodor Dreyer, which it is a tedious film, but it is also one of the best looking movies you will ever see in your life.
I mean, so it's a hell of a biblical film noir.
Yeah.
Oh, wait.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's the story of an unrepentant jerk who you do not like at any point in the movie, nor does he give you a reason to like him. He's a horrible person who tries to solve his own murder by brute forcing his way through it with the power of white privilege and still does a terrible job and only discovers his murderer by accident after guessing wrong.
It's so weird because there are critical responses to this film that talk about what a great job Edmund O'Brien did. And I just don't think Edmund O'Brien was properly cast. It wasn't even so much that he was bad. It was just like, wait, what? So here's a
really
his character is supposed
stern
to be
white guy.
And you don't, and there's a point at, there are several points at which he kind of loses his marbles and is like, oh my God, I'm going to die. And you're just like, yeah, but you're still an angry, annoying white dude, and you're still just gonna like run through the streets and hit people to the best of your ability. And I mean, I like the nothing to lose aspect because there is a lot in film noir of, well, I'm gonna hold a gun on you or I'm gonna threaten you because I am the designated gangster and therefore you're gonna melt. And there is a lot of I don't have anything to lose about Edmund O'Brien's performance, but he's not a sympathetic character.
No, like I could see early 90s Harrison Ford doing a really good job with this kind of a story. Right? I've got nothing to lose. I'm going to die, but I'm going to take you down with me because you killed me. Right? That's, again, that's a great hook. You know, and it's kind of the reverse of The Fugitive where he's hunting down someone. And I mean, it's so much fun in an alternate reality. But, you know, this guy is just awful. And every choice he makes is wrong. Every choice he makes is kind of curious. And like, you know, he's like, oh, why did all of this happen to me? Oh, wait, I did notarize that thing for that guy whose name I suddenly recognized, but I didn't recognize when I first heard it. It's like, what? And, you know, why is he going on vacation? Why is he going away from his fiance?
He's going on vacation because he's a creep. Because he has a woman who adores him and is like, please don't do anything to break my heart. I love you so much. And his response is, thanks, honey. Bye. I'm going to San Francisco for a week and I'm going to immediately start ogling every lady I see.
But at the same time, like every word out of her mouth, like once in a while, she's fine. But every word out of her mouth is like, yeah, that's why he's going on vacation away from you, lady. Oh, I did not like
her. It's kind of true. But I didn't. I wanted to like her. I really did.
Yeah.
I wanted to believe Edmund O'Brien was a terrible person and that it's weird that he takes off to San Francisco for a week and he's wearing a suit and a hat and whatever and he's staying in a convention hotel because he's got to get away from this woman who's oppressing him. But she's irritating. I'm sorry. Even toward the end when they're having their like love clinch or whatever and he's like, could you just wait in the lobby? And both of them are annoying in that moment.
She is pretty dreadful and simpering. Yeah. The actress is very sympathetic, and I like her face. It's an unusual and striking and interesting face. But, yeah, there's no one to like. Well, maybe Majak. The character who leaps off the screen, who you're like, I want to see more of that guy, is the sweaty, terrifying psychopath. You're like, someone I can enjoy the presence of.
He's like, I'm a bad dude, but you sort of fell into my world. I didn't really want you here, but now I have to kill you because that's what I do.
And that's one of those, it's that guy's. It's Luther Adler,
right?
Who is usually really good. I remember first seeing Luther Adler in a three-part episode of the classic Hawaii Five-O as the head of a crime family. And each episode, it's, you know, Steve McGarrett taking down one generation of the crime family. And it, until finally he goes face head-to-head with Luther Adler. It's fantastic! It's a trilogy called V for Vachon. And so, yeah, if you want to go look up Classic 5-0, well worth watching. Much better story than this.
Hands down, the best moment in the entire film is when, so Majak is a crime lord. Bigelow stumbles into his operation completely by accident. It's a total red herring. Majak has little, if to nothing, to do with what actually happened to our quote-unquote hero, Frank Bigelow. So there, Majak is being really cool and calm and just like, yeah, I'm probably going to have to kill you. I don't like to, but, you know, it's business. And they're walking through his house and Bigelow lunges for a door. And without looking back, without missing a beat, Majak says, "That's a closet, Mr. Bigelow," and then continues his monologue. And I laughed out loud.
It's so good.
It's so great.
That's my favorite scene.
I really enjoy that a lot. You know, he's great. Like they give him, you're right, there's this huge red herring plot. Like, it's not just, okay, let's go down a little red herring alley. It's like there's a whole street full of red herrings, and it's going to take us a while to get all the way down, and then we're going to turn around and we're going to come back. And by the end, it's going to be like, you know, explication. It's like, blah, 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 blah. That's why this was a red herring, and so-and-so did so-and-so to what? And you're like, I don't care. I just don't care anymore. I mean, I'm never, not sure that I ever did, but there's not, for the audience, there's just not a payoff of, oh, that's what you did, or that's how you got into the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, and the plot by the end is so complicated, and this one guy has gone around taking care of everyone who might know about this notarized bill of sale, and how did he know that Edmund O'Brien was going to be in San Francisco on his vacation? How did he know he was going to be in this jazz bar that he goes to on a whim? I mean, it's a bit much. It's a bit much.
I mean, I do like the idea that it's just a guy, an ordinary guy. He did a totally ordinary, random thing in the course of his business, and it ends up dooming him. That's interesting. That's compelling.
That is.
The execution, though, is this random, sweaty, middle-aged dude just barreling into a series of rooms, screaming at people, sometimes beating up ladies, getting his facts, then finding out he has gotten his facts completely wrong, running away, and then coming back later to do it all over again.
Totally. And I do think there are sort of weird bits in, where Edmund O'Brien forces his way into rooms and yells at people and, you know, fights because, again, he has nothing to lose. But there are sort of weird little moments where he a little Columbos it a little bit and goes, so why didn't you say the thing about the thing if you knew about the thing? And then you're like, oh, okay, so we're actually going to put these threads of the plot together. And I guess you could say, if you drew it out, like if you were sitting there in your movie theater seat in 1950 with a diagram, you could I suspect the plot works, like if you sort it that way. But that's not how anyone watches a movie. So you're left with the idea that Edmund O'Brien, auditor by day, you know, detective by night, I guess. Interestingly enough, so a little later on in his career, he plays yours truly, Johnny Dollar, an investigator on an old time radio show. And I could talk.
Oh, I know that show.
Yeah. Well, and he is one of the lesser of the many Johnny Dollars. But the point is, there are points in Edmund O'Brien's career where he applies detective chops. This movie is kind of an interesting non-example of that.
All the parts in this movie that work the best are the least essential. Chester, Neville Brand,
Chester,
in his first credited role as Chester, the sweaty, bug-eyed psychopath, like Biff Tannen meets Hannibal Lecter.
With the high waters. Don't forget the super high water pants he's got.
I love him. He is my kind of sweaty, bug-eyed psychopath. He's just that certain, back in the 1950s when, you know, they knew that psychopaths existed, but they weren't interested in portraying them with any kind of subtlety. So you just had guys running around going, I like to hurt people. It's fun to hurt people. Oh, man, it's so much fun. But the scene where Bigelow has to escape from Chester, and then later on the scene where he's on the bus and Majak is tailing him in the car, two crackerjack sequences, beautifully shot, beautifully edited, you know, incredibly well staged with great use of tracking shots and real-world locations. And neither of them has anything to do with the plot whatsoever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's as if they said to him, can you Richard Widmark it up, but like dial it up about 10 notches?
But I love it. It sails over the top, but compared to everything else in this movie, at least with Chester, you're like, finally, someone I enjoy watching.
Yeah.
Well, and his motivations, remember, are personal because, yeah, he's sent out to rough Edmund O'Brien up by Majak. But the reason we have that conversation in the car where he's like, I'm going to get you in the belly, it's personal. It's because O'Brien has roughed him up back and because O'Brien has talked smart. And Chester is like, I'm not used to that. And it's not going to stand. And I'm going to cut you, basically.
And he embarrassed Chester in front of his uncle.
Right.
And that, like, yeah, finally in this film, we have a clear motivation rooted in character that makes sense. And Neville Brand's performance, especially for a guy who was pretty much fresh out of the army with only a couple of uncredited roles, you know, to his name, apparently a highly decorated World War II veteran who just got bitten by the acting bug. For a guy who's like doing his first speaking part, he is knocking it out of the park. He steals every scene he's in.
He's given a good part, too, because there are the three guys. When you first meet him and those other two guys who ambush O'Brien in his hotel room, there's a couple of other guys in that scene. But Chester is given the best lines. And I want to believe that that's the director going, OK, this guy is interesting, not only the character that we've created for him, but just the way he's doing it. And I've seen other actors do that kind of part in ways that I find more interesting, but I think he does a great job with what he's given, and I think they gave him some great lines, and they gave him a scene alone with the star of the movie where he gets to do some really interesting things.
He's just entertaining in a movie where so many people are actively unpleasant to watch. And it's an interesting, it's over the top, but it's an interesting kind of over the top. The steady rictus grin, the unblinking, wide staring eyes, that's a choice and it's an interesting one.
Hmm, definitely.
Oh, yeah. No, he clearly takes pleasure in his work.
That's a trope that you see a fair bit in noirs or gangster movies where you've got the muscle who's clearly enjoying what he does, or at the very least, he understands what he does in terms of, okay, now you get to hurt. And yeah, so it's sort of a horror movie trope in that way. But yeah, Chester is interesting. But again, I would say it's all relative because most of the rest of the people in this movie are sort of unpleasant and unenjoyable to watch, including, sadly, our lead. So let's talk about Paula. So Edmund O'Brien has this pre-existing relationship with Paula, who works for him, and she wants nothing.
That's not shady.
his confidential secretary,
right,
unquote.
Right. And he's like an auditor or some such accounting auditor thing in a small town in California. I didn't look up where Banning, California is, but I'm going to assume that it's quite a distance away from either L.A. or San Francisco. And he's got this relationship with Paula, and all she wants in the world is to put a ring on it. And he's like, you know, and the thing is that the way I can't decide whether it's the way the character of Paula is drawn herself in terms of the script or what, but I have a small amount of sympathy for O'Brien in terms of, like, she's really putting pressure on him, and I wanted to feel like, okay, well, we're coming in the middle of this relationship. Maybe they've had a long-term relationship and he's made promises, or they've had such a relationship that she believes that it's a reasonable expectation, and he's like, you know what, baby? I'm going to leave for a week. I forgot to tell you. So sorry. Which would be annoying. But everything they give that actress to do in the whole movie is irritating because later on, like at the beginning, she's an irritant to him. But later on, she's actively sort of like, hey, man, I'm trying to investigate my own murder, which I'm not telling you about. And you're really, you know, crimping my style here because I'm trying to figure out who's killing me. But all you want to do is talk about love. And so it's kind
of
weird.
She doesn't know.
I know. I understand that. Uh-huh. And yeah, the last time she sees him is like, hey, go wait in the lobby. And she, you know, puts her head in her hands. And it's like, and you know, if you've seen the movie before, that's the last time they're going to see each other. And it's pretty, pretty bad for her.
I mean, if he had started out by saying, baby, I got to go have my rumspringa, that would have been fine. She'd have been like, oh, totally. The thing that gets me is, so the whole movie is told as a flashback, right? He's telling the cops what has happened to him. And, you know, when it does finally come back to him at the end, and you're just like, well, that's it. That's everything that happened. And then he suddenly looks stricken and goes, tell my fiance Paula, and he falls over dead. And I don't know that he makes the noise, but it's so much more entertaining with the noise. But I'm just like, what? But,
Right. He could have said, hey, Paula, honey, why don't you come with me to the police station? Because I'm going to tell a story or something.
I will tell you the whole story. And even then, you know, the cops are like, what should we do? Well, go find his fiance, but don't tell her anything.
Which is, well, that's one of my least favorite tropes about anything to do with medicine or cops, where it's like, well, we're not going to tell the person that's critically engaged in this story in some way, because that would cause them to freak the hell out. Famously, like, to get back to radio drama, which is just another thing that I love and I've been thinking about today for some weird reason, in radio versions of Dragnet, and maybe they did it in television as well, often the cop would say, and we went to see Mrs. Smith, and we told her some bad news, and her doctor gave her a sedative, and 10 hours later we questioned her. It was just like, oh my God!
One of my favorite running jokes on Arrested Development would be whenever anyone had to be in the hospital for any reason, and everyone would be waiting for news, and the doctor would come out and be very grim. They're like, oh, no, he's fine. But it was always that, you know, the doctor building up and building up to, oh, he's fine.
You know, when Frank Bigelow keels over at the end, you know, it's that, that internet expression, and nothing of value was lost.
Right.
But it would have been
such
so much
bad death scene.
It's very bad.
It's like he's about to turn into the Wolfman or something. He just falls out of sight behind the desk. But I mean, it would have been so interesting if at the start of the movie he's like, call my fiance, I need to see her. And they call her, and like the whole time he's recounting she's on her way, and then he dies before she gets there. That would have at least added some pathos. But no, we're not meant to care about any of these people. They're horrible.
Exactly. No, the scene the scene at the beginning where he's going through the cop shop and getting to the homicide, I love that scene. I love it visually.
That's a great scene.
It's really a great scene. But the end and the way he just collapses and crumples in front of a desk and you don't even really see him, and they go around and they go, DOA. It's really a letdown, and you're right. They could have either had the fiance, had Paula trying to get there. I suppose you could even have had her in the room in the background sort of making anguished faces or something. But what's the point of having this relationship? The only point of that relationship in his experience throughout this movie is as an annoyance. There's no point at which she's solace for him, and that's not even really her fault. It's the way they chose to structure the movie. I mean, yes, I think there are a lot of cases in which places in which she's annoying, including sort of the end scene where it's like, okay, I'm going to have a serious romance novel kind of a love scene, and Edmund O'Brien, being Edmund O'Brien, is going to go, "I love you, honey," and it's going to be dreadful. But it's not the actress's fault; it's the script's fault.
Oh,
and
absolutely!
It's just dumb.
And I've seen baking soda volcanoes with more chemistry than those two.
Right.
She's basically what Dennis Miller called his character in the movie The Net, an expositional eunuch. Except she does actually supposedly have some kind of relationship with him, but we don't really see it. But she is there to provide information. Right. She's the one who says, oh, yeah, you did notarize this thing. And oh, yeah, these names are familiar. And, you know, it's just so weird. But
right.
They
and then his response is
in
sort
the office.
Of, and then his response is sort of like, OK, thanks for the information. Got to go, baby.
Thanks, baby. I'm going to L.A.
Right.
What?
Wait, what?
Make her his sister? Don't have them be in a relationship.
Exactly.
Make her his sister. Mm-hmm. That way there's still a familial tie. She still has reason to worry about him. It's not creepy when he, you know, faffs off to L.A. to go ogle women with a slide whistle in his pocket. Yes, can we talk about that for a moment?
Let's talk about the slide whistle.
I was like, is something wrong with the audio on this film?
It's like, you know, you haven't been poisoned, sir. You just have delusions of slide whistles. What the hell? I'm sorry. There is another term I could use, but we don't want to put an explicit tag on the thing. What the hell?
Audience, just so you understand, as part of many, many Looney Tunes-like musical choices in this film, I mean, the composer, Dmitry Tiomkin, he's a big deal composer.
He is.
But for some reason, he'll do the thing where, like, our hero is taking a step and the music goes bump, 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 bum, 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 in time with his steps. Well, whenever Edmund O'Brien sees a pretty, well, pretty, I'm putting air quotes around pretty because it's the 1950s and we have to lower our standards, a pretty woman in this movie, an actual slide whistle on the sidetrack soundtrack goes, whoop, whoop. It is the
weirdest thing in this movie. The funny thing is, I had forgotten about it because just a little behind the scenes there. So we agreed to do this movie, and we have our little Slack channel where we can chat about it. And Nathan mentioned the slide whistle, and I'd completely erased it from my mind. I think I'd blocked it because it's just stupid.
it's just stupid, and you know, it actually interrupts dialogue.
It does.
Pauses for the slide whistle, which is especially weird. And, I mean, for a long time, the weirdest use of a slide whistle in a film for me had been in The Man with the Golden Gun, when James Bond does this insane jump with like, the car literally corkscrews to jump from one side of a broken bridge to the other, where they're twisted. And it's a really impressive stunt, except as soon as the car goes airborne, you're...
That seems like that would wreck it.
And it destroys. Yeah, it destroys whatever tension you've got going on. And this tops that use of the slide whistle. This is literally insane.
I mean, I can see if you had a guy hanging out in the lobby, because the premise here is he's checking into this hotel. There's a bunch of conventioners. And that's what I thought it was at first. I thought it was like, oh, there's one of these dudes who's with the convention. And every time he sees a pretty lady, he does this. But no, it follows Edmund O'Brien up to his hotel room where he says, leave the door open so that he can hear the party across the hall, or in the hall, I should say. And it's weird, and it's incongruous with the rest of the movie, as well as just being weird.
Like, it would be hilarious if it were a guy in the lobby and then Edmund O'Brien looks at him like, what are you doing?
Right.
Yes.
That would be funny. That would be a nice touch.
It would go well with the "that's a closet, Mr. Bigelow."
Yeah.
But no.
Because that's the thing. Like, you think in the beginning, Edmund O'Brien, he's going on vacation in Chicago, but he sees all these conventioneers. But he's like, oh, I don't want any part of that because they're kind of loud and weird and they're probably being disrespectful to women or whatever. But the first thing he does is leave the door open because he wants to be part of this ridiculous, debauched thing. And he ends up going to this bar where the jazz is really hot and people are bouncing up and down a lot.
And people are insane in the jazz bar.
Insane.
It's like, you know, I love good jazz, and I have never felt like dancing like that or reacting like that. Or
I feel like they're using jazz as some sort of drug metaphor. It reminds me a little bit of Reefer Madness, where it's like, oh my God, hot trombone, I'm going to lose my mind.
Yeah, it's like an instructional video, like one of those like warning videos they showed you in high school health class. When white people try to be cool.
And then, of course, that gives him license to sidle up to. And it's funny because I've seen this movie 3 or 4 times. And this is the time when I was like, he is, you know, 100% like checking out this particular woman and isolating her through the bartender and who's a lady? And he goes over and like, you know, can I buy you a drink? And she's completely willing. There's no like, you know, chicanery in that regard. But your perspective on Edmund O'Brien is he's not playing the innocent who has somehow landed in this den of iniquity. He absolutely chooses to be where he is. And he may not deserve lethal poisoning, but he's not he's not being faithful to Paula in that moment in any sense.
No, and it is interesting. The use of the flashback allows for some interesting tension in these early scenes. When is the hammer going to drop? And the movie very skillfully employs some red herrings. So is he going to be poisoned by the jealous husband whose wife is pawing at him? Is this woman at the bar going to have anything to do with it? And while on one hand, it's kind of dumb that this lady at the bar has one scene and never reappears and has nothing to do with the plot, it's also kind of interesting that they would throw away, you know, lead you down that blind alley on purpose to throw you off the real plot.
Yeah, I kind of like that, actually. I mean, there are too many red herrings that involve the sort of the Majak Chester of it all, you know, all the people that are involved in the Iridium deal. But I like the woman as, oh, that's clearly where he went wrong because he, you know, allowed himself to get tangled up with this woman who clearly poisoned him. Well, no, she had nothing to do with it. And you're right. We never see her again. And I enjoy that. I think if you're going to deploy red herrings, you have to be fairly skillful about it and also not have such a complicated main plot. If you had a simpler main plot and you still had a couple of red herrings, sort of like, okay, you got me. I'm into that. That's great.
It also helps if you have a likable main character who you don't want to see die.
I mean, for instance, I've been watching Only Murders in the Building on Hulu, which is a delightful 10-episode mystery comedy series with Steve Martin and Martin Short and Selena Gomez. And that is so nicely crafted. They just finished. They stuck the landing. There are red herrings that work beautifully, but they're not too many of them. It never gets totally confusing, but it's just confusing enough that you get, oh, hey, it does work at the end of it. And I wish more mysteries were careful with their red herring deployment.
Well, I mean, there's so much in this movie about Edmund O'Brien just being like aggressive and just sort of, you know, hammering at things or running at things. And you know, there's a point when he's going to doctors and he's finding out what's wrong with him, where he kind of freaks out in as good a way as Edmund O'Brien is capable of freaking out. It's like, oh my God, he goes through the stages of grief, by which I mean denial. That's the one he does. And then he goes to
anger,
right? Well, there's some denial in there too, but yes, you're right. I guess he gets a stage and a half, whatever. And then he goes to another doctor.
He gets denanger.
Denanger. And he barges into a hospital. I do enjoy the amount of cinematography done in San Francisco and Los Angeles, so that he doesn't just go, I'm going to go to another doctor's office. I'm going to go up a hospital with a giant set of steps, and I'm going to walk in. I'm going to barge in on another doctor who's immediately going to go, oh, you're another white guy. I'll see you right away. And give him a second.
I love when he barges into the emergency room office and the nurses are trying to fight him off.
Right, but the doctor's like, come on in, dude. Let's just say you're a white man in distress, so clearly we should talk.
Yeah.
You're a white man. I'm a white man. Let me help you.
I will say I love the cinematography in this film. I love the way they use real places to add depth and dimension. You know, when it's a set, it's ugly and cheap looking. And I think the filmmakers know that. And so when they use, the Bradbury Building, be still my heart. Mm-hmm. It's gorgeous.
Great.
All the use of real locations is wonderful. There are some clever shots in this film. When he realizes he's going to die and he posts up against a newsstand to catch his breath, and it's next to a strip of Life magazines, so that life.
That's great.
That's pretty clever. And I love the use of tracking shots in action scenes. There are a couple of continuous one-take tracking shots where first when he's being fired on from the warehouse by somebody, whoever, you know, it's Edmund O'Brien. At this point in the movie, we're not surprised that anyone would try to shoot him. The camera is moving.
Die faster.
Die faster. The camera moves with him as he is, you know, navigating this maze of pipes and things, and gunshots are going off all around him. That's really cool. And they do it again later when he's trying to hide from Chester in a drugstore. They follow him, you know, at his level along the counter of the drugstore with Chester on the other side. And there are some cool scenes in this movie that are well done. And it is wasted, like a great premise, it is wasted on this particular set of circumstances. Yeah.
Well, the tracking shots as he's freaking out and he just runs out in the street and runs out through the crowds. That's one of the most famous stolen shots in all of cinema, because they did not have permits to shoot there. They did not set up like complicated, you know, these are not extras. These are just people on the street who are like, who the hell is this guy pushing through me? But it works. It really works for the panic and for the reactions. They're all very natural.
I love stolen shots.
I do too. I really enjoy it because that is the point at which it seems least controlled. Because if you think about other movies where people are evading capture, they're not usually flat out running. I mean, they may be climbing around in warehouses as he does later on, but you don't see somebody who's flat out running and who's running in the street for a prolonged period of time, and where the people are sort of blurs as they go by. They're like large crowds of people as blurs, and you can tell that it's not, you know, 47 extras exactly positioned in this way. I love that. I love the warehouse thing feels like a trope to me, because there's so many noir movies where somehow somebody ends up in a space with a lot of ladders or stairs where somebody is high and somebody is low and somebody's hiding behind a barrel. And so that sort of bored me. But I love the scene where Majak is in the car in the convertible and Edmund O'Brien is on the bus and they're tracking together. And that's really great. And, you know, don't think about, well, does he really know the route of this bus? And what's that? Anyway, I like that. I like so, and I, as I said, I like the beginning. I like the very stylized way that the police department looks like some great government building. And I read in some review somewhere where they referred to it as a precinct station. It's like, no, I don't think that's a precinct station. I think that's probably meant to be the HQ of the LA police, because that's quite an impressive building. And I feel like the choices that they make about where to deploy really interesting cinematography throughout the movie are great and enjoyable. And they really, and I say this as somebody who is usually motivated more by plot-related things in films than I am cinematography. Like, I enjoy great cinematography, but if that's the only thing that a movie has to recommend it, I'm usually not as engaged. But I feel like for this movie, especially as weird as the plot is, the cinematography absolutely makes it. And it's delightful to watch. Mm-hmm. And the movie's length is such that it feels entirely watchable. There's no point at which you're bored because of the length of the movie.
Yeah, you could watch this with the sound turned off, and it's a fascinating thing to watch.
You should watch this with the sound turned off, except when Chester comes on. Turn it on for Chester. You'll know when he appears. He's the freaky looking dude.
Well, there you go. That's our review, friend.
And that was you know, I grew up with, you know, my mother was an English professor, among other things, and she trained me that a film that you could watch without the sound and not quite catch the plot, and a film that you could listen to without watching and you still couldn't quite catch the plot, you needed both. That was a good film. And this is one where you really don't need to listen. It's beautiful to watch. And, you know, do you need to know what's going on? Yeah, you just need to know he's going to die. And when you get to the end and he drops dead, hey, you're done. That's the movie. But it's really fascinating to watch it.
It is really gutsy well that shot. He dies at the end, because you keep wondering, is there going to be some out? Is he going to get a happy ending at the end? Nope. Yeah. I appreciate that they followed through that. Plus, by that point, you're like, die, Frank Bigelow, die. The world will lose nothing by your passing.
It's kind of like, and this is a spoiler for the movie, Penn and Teller Get Killed. At the end of the movie, Penn and Teller get killed. And we know they don't really in real life. And the voiceover at the end is Penn saying, what, you thought we'd name the thing Penn and Teller Get Killed and not get killed? Come on, we have to pay that off.
Integrity, man. I think the worst thing about that final scene is just the bad way that it's done. Like, he's collapsing across a desk, and there's so many other ways that they... And it doesn't have to be overdramatic. It doesn't have to be a scenery-chewing thing. God forbid he should have a last romantic clinch with Paula and go, I'm sorry. He should never do that. But I love the idea. I can think of several ways to do it. Like I said before,
he should not have any interaction with Paula whatsoever.
I agree. I mean, the only thing I could is maybe if she's like standing in the doorway and we find out later that she's been listening as he's been telling his story. So she finally understands and you can sort of see a couple of facial expressions. Sure. But no, he should absolutely not have any interactions with her.
I mean, I keep wondering, having, you know, worked with actors so much and, you know, and seeing how they try to figure out how to do this, it's the joke, what's my motivation? But it is literally, how do I make this look believable? How do I make this motion or movement look believable? And there is nothing in his death that is even remotely, I mean, it's not even gravity. He sort of lurches off to the side and turns in midair and drops, and you don't see anything.
It's kind of like, oh, yeah, we have to kill him. We forgot.
Yeah. And everybody gathers around him and just
Super Mario Brothers.
It's funny you should say Super Mario Brothers, but I'll get to that. There's a connection. But yeah, it's just so weird that he sort of falls out of frame and doesn't actually, like, we don't actually see a death scene. And I'm wondering, was he just not able to do it? You know, they all just sort of gather around him and they're like, oh, he's dead. Okay.
He's a time lord. He's regenerating. He's going to pop back up and it's going to be a different actor in the same clothes.
It's so weird.
No, I doubt it.
As for the Super Mario Brothers, there is a connection, crazily enough, because the 1988 remake, DOA, was directed by the directors of what will be familiar to Rocket Surgery listeners and Flophouse listeners, the live-action Super Mario Brothers movie with Bob Hoskins and John Leguizamo,
ooh,
which is just bizarre. So there you go.
So my only 1988 DOA connection, somehow DOA was filmed, parts of DOA were filmed in, 1988
right.
DOA were filmed in a location where a friend of my sister's was living. And so she was an extra in DOA. And it was not a movie that we would have necessarily gone to see at that point. But it's all like, well, Fiona is in this movie. You have to go see it and you'll blink if you miss her. So that was the only thing.
Right. It's set down in Austin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For whatever reason.
Right. I don't know that either.
The thing that cracks me up, so we've talked about how weird this movie is. And the 1988 one, and I will just read this from the plot summary. The next morning, Dennis Quaid's character, feeling his sickness is more than just a hangover, which is a phrase from this movie, stops by the medical clinic and blah, blah, blah. And then he goes to find the woman that he flirted with at the bar. They actually make her more of a character, played by Meg Ryan, whom he kidnaps. This is the part I'm quoting. Whom he kidnaps by super gluing himself to her arm.
Okay.
What?
Anyway. Because anyway. He carries super glue. I don't know.
There's just something about these movies.
Wait, what if one of them has to go to the bathroom?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And
there you go.
But no slide whistle, so.
Thank
I feel like this
God.
Movie would have been improved by a super glued arm or two. There's very little you could do that would make this film worse.
You got to think Chester's carrying.
Well, sure. I mean, and my favorite, you know, Chester, of course, all hail Chester. But I do love the part
I'm
where.
I glue myself to your gut, man.
Right. It's early so in the movie, we found out that what makes Edmund O'Brien feel bad about being poisoned is his stomach. And so Chester immediately clocks that that's the guy's weak spot. Right. So he's nobody is going to enjoy being punched in the belly, but Edmund O'Brien particularly. And that is Chester's joy in life, is that I get to punch him in the belly. And for a moment, as often happens in a movie like this, his boss calls him off and says, Chester, later. No, don't do it now. And usually that means that the henchman is sent away and, oh, I didn't get to hurt the guy. But then very soon, Bajak calls him back and goes, Chester, it's okay. You're going to go by yourself and you're going to get to kill him. And then there's this interminable drive where Chester just threatens him mercifully, vocally. And just like, we're just driving, two guys in suits in a convertible in L.A. And Chester just like, I'm going to get you in the belly. Hey, you don't like that, do you? It's delightful.
It really is. He just nails these. He's that certain kind of 1940s, 1950s sweaty, bug-eyed psychopath that you just love to watch.
There was a point in that scene where I flashed into Pulp Fiction and I'm thinking, you know
what they call a gut shot in France, Frank? They call it a royale.
And, you know, I was just, yeah. Such a weird movie, but I love looking at it.
It is very pretty. Oh, the scenes of the Bradbury building alone. It's like ice cream for your eyes.
It is. I love it.
And like I said earlier, if you love the Bradbury building, seek out the Demon with a Glass Hand episode of The Outer Limits, the original Outer Limits. It's an excellent episode. It's one of the best in the series. And the entire thing is shot inside the Bradbury building and uses it beautifully.
I know in L.A. there are various tours you can take of famous film scenes or sets or whatever, you know, places that became well-known for film. And I don't know, and I lived near San Francisco for a number of years, but I don't know if that exists in San Francisco where they say, you know, here's where we did this movie or that movie. But I think that would actually be much more interesting.
Oh, yeah.
I think they tore down the Bradbury building a few years ago, sadly. I know they used a building modeled on it in Pushing Daisies, but I don't know if that was like a set with CGI or what. But I think I read that the Bradbury building was torn down, which breaks my heart.
That's sad.
I would say I have gone around San Francisco looking at things and going, oh, that was in Bullet. That was in What's Up, Doc. That was in DOA, you know.
I am happily wrong. The Bradbury building is still standing.
Oh, good to know.
Oh, good.
I'll put a link to that because people should see what building we're talking about. Well, friends, thanks for joining us for this discussion of DOA, a really pretty film. Don't pay attention to plots or lead actors or anything like that. Just look at it. It's pretty. Let it wash over you. It's worth your time. Absolutely. 1949 by Rudolph Matey. We'll be back next time with a very, very different movie starring Betty Davis. It's called All This in Heaven, Too. So if noir is not your jam, stick with us for episode 41. You can follow us over at theincomparable.com/LTS, or you can follow the show at Lion Tower Shield on Twitter, because S's cost extra. Bye now.